no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in DC. Today, my returning guest is one of my favorites, David Pepper. He's a lawyer, a writer, a political activist, former elected official, adjunct professor, and served as the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party between 2015 and 2021. He's the author of Laboratories of Autocracy and Saving Democracy. Can't wait to get into this with him, but before I do, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get a bonus What's Up episode just for patrons every Tuesday. It's kind of like my online journal, where I get a little more personal and I talk about whatever's on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Now please enjoy my conversation with David Pepper. Welcome back to the show, David.
Oh, great to be with you. Thanks.
It's good to have you, even though we're going through some really trying times. I'm hoping that our conversation can not only help us kind of see things more clearly, but, you know, some of the listeners out there who we have all these questions. And I do want to start off with a couple of things that I think are kind of positive in this chaotic mess. And first, I just want to talk to you about it. Last night, trade courts blocked Trump's tariffs, saying that they're illegal.
Right.
So woohoo for that. And we keep seeing Trump, you know, he says there's going to be tariffs, and then he backs away from them. The whole taco meme is happening. Trump always chickens out. So here's my question to you about this. Do you think that, number one, Trump is going to even follow these court orders? I know he's fighting them, but regardless of fighting them, do you think he's just going to start saying to other countries and whatnot, okay, we're going to impose tariffs on you? And if he does, what does that mean for the bigger picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, two things. One, to be my the optimist, which I generally is what keeps me going every day, Trump is doing us a huge favor in that he's doing everything by executive order, which many of which are illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to think about how do we stop what's happening is we need to delay everything to as much as possible to get ourselves to at least a Democratic House.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent his first maneuver on everything from tariffs to getting in the Department of Education to all of it, most of the internal stuff at least, is all illegal. Like he is not doing the lawmaking process the Constitution requires, which is Congress has a role.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not read the opinion yet. Apparently it's very long and complicated, but I think the essence of many of these rulings is Congress is given a role, or Congress created the Department of Education, and you can't just do this by executive order. So the good news is whatever he does, all of it is buying time for us to win in a year and a half and then stop it all. It'd be much more worrisome, and he's doing it with this terrible budget bill. But if these things were actually going through Congress, let's say the Congress dismantled the Department of Education through a bill, that would happen. There'd be no way to stop that. And so on the trade, like other things, his first step has been so lawless that if the goal in the end is to keep it from happening, he's sort of done us a favor by being continuously sort of violative of the Constitution, every step he's taken. So if he wants to drag that out and play it out, and every once in a while, he had a win last week with independent agencies with the Supreme Court, But for the most part, even in the hands of this court, I think what he's doing is not consistent with the Constitution. And that does give us some time to stop things when everything is about getting ourselves to a new Congress that won't vote for this stuff in the first place.
Wow. So, okay. Now, do you think, like, what happens if he just defies these court orders and he starts saying, I'm going to impose tariffs on China?
What happens is, and this is something that, you know, this is the frustration I have. And these are all related, although they don't seem like it. You know, Abrego Garcia is sitting in an El Salvador jail now, despite violation at this point of three court orders. And so right now he's losing in court, but when he violates the orders, they're not being tough enough. Mm-hmm. So if he does that, if this judicial system, all but the John Roberts, does not start to say, you can be held in contempt, you will be, there will be real sanctions, be it finance or jail time, unless the courts do that, then we really do lose the rule of law. I don't mean to be so dramatic about it. I mean, again, the idea, I mean, when was Van Hollen and down in El Salvador? It was like a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court ordered him to basically order the people, the administration to facilitate his release in late April. Mm-hmm. The idea that he's still there, obviously it's terrible for his family and him, but it's a matter of the rule of law when multiple courts have said he needs to be here, should scare us. And mm-hmm. if Trump is learning from that, hey, I'll just do it again on tariffs or Department of Ed. Like, yeah, that's scary. And one worry I have is the courts worry they can't enforce these orders. Mm-hmm. So then they don't issue them. Well, if you don't issue them because you fear you can't enforce them, then basically the rule of law is already gone.
Yeah.
So these courts need to step up. And then the appeals need to be quick. And then John Roberts, who gave a speech not long ago that he worried about the rule of law going away, it's about time he did something about that. And that would ultimately mean enforcing contempt orders against whoever it is that's breaking the law, so they're held accountable for it.
Oh, my God. So all these things are swirling in my head, and now they've all swirled out of them, out of my head. But I guess my question for you then is, you had mentioned that, you know, this whole thing with the tariffs, it might be good because it delays time, or it's delays until the midterms. So here's the way I look at it. Like, obviously it is the voters. That's the only shot we've got, because we can't really trust mainstream media. There are some in mainstream media that I feel are trustworthy, but so much of mainstream media is not, and they're not doing their jobs. And we are seeing the Supreme Court and the courts of the United States in some cases doing their jobs. And like you said, they're not enforcing necessarily what they're issuing, the judgments issuing. I can't even speak. Their judgments about Trump, he's just right, ignoring them. So my whole point about this is I'm hoping, I guess, this is like my hopeful thought, that if the American public sees what's happening and they see that the courts are telling him you can't do this, whether it's with Garcia or tariffs or not, and then he's just defying them, that when we do get to the midterms, it's going to be probably, I mean, this is again my hope, bigger than what we saw in 2018, which was, you know, general election turnout. Do you think that would be the result of what's happening, since
we
it's
need
so
that
horrible now? Yeah.
And this is, by the way, this is the other reason why the courts enforcing orders through contempt, if needed, is so important. If you watch Trump, they never care if they lose a case. They literally just say, oh, that's a liberal judge, we don't care. They just don't care. But they're very careful to say, if you look at Bondi or Trump or any of them, we do not break orders. They actually know the politics of violating court orders is a problem. So yes, you want the electorate to see, and courts being tough make it clear. If courts cave, then the Trump people say, oh, look, you know, they didn't really find us in contempt, so we're not really guilty. And they're able to lie about what is essentially lawbreaking. I think the optics of them violating orders is very bad politics, and they mm-hmm. know it. Losing a lawsuit is not bad optics. They just blame the judge. Violating orders like flying planes to another country, that Trump's numbers on immigration went underwater for the first time ever because he looked like he was breaking the law. So I do think that in the end, that the politics of open lawbreaking is not good for them with a majority. And that's one of many things, in addition to Medicaid cuts, going to town on public schools across states like Ohio. Add all that up, Social Security attacks, add all that up. Yeah, we need to have a very loud, decisive set of special elections every time, whether it's a mayor's race or a state house race or a state senate. We need to have a big set of results in Virginia this November, mm-hmm. New Jersey, and then we need to roll. And if it's milquetoast, or if it, God forbid, is 2002 where Bush did better because of mm-hmm. the response to 9/11, then I'd worry that it all goes on steroids. And so a very, very loud, firm, decisive pushback. And when I say this, I mean not just winning a few slivers of races that you might expect in a midterm, but all of a sudden, you know, let's say Sherrod Brown runs for Senate in Ohio. He flips his seat back. Like something that, and this is what's happened in the past, something that's more surprising than a Biden plus two district staying blue or a Trump plus two district going blue. My worry is it has to be more decisive than that to have the impact of really a real message that this is an overreach. I felt a little better. I worry though that, and you see it, you know, every day we read about a book of, you know, Tapper's book and all. Mm-hmm. If we normalize how crazy it all is right now, that makes it less likely that could happen. So I do think we have to keep explaining to people how, whether it's, you know, destroying the public education or DOGE or, you know, all this, or the tariffs jacking costs up on everybody. We have to keep people seeing that none of this is normal, and to vote accordingly, because if it settles in as normal, then it becomes normal. And then we're really stuck in an era that none of us want to be part of.
Oh yeah. All right, I want to switch gears. And, you know, the other piece of information that we got yesterday that seems kind of like a win or a positive is that Elon Musk is leaving the White House. Now, I have to say, he got what he wanted, right? He got his data. He was able to use Doge to go in and do whatever he wanted to do. And, you know, and there's some on social media who are framing this as if it's a big win. And then there's also other people kind of framing it like, well, I think even Alison Gill had mentioned, well, this is just going to be like, I can't remember I can't remember the name of the person, but he goes away, but they're still working together. So what we know is Elon Musk has had conversations with Vladimir Putin. We know that he was all up in the White House and up in Donald Trump's campaign before the election, and nobody knows exactly what was going on, but we saw a lot of it. I mean, trying to buy votes, all of that horrible stuff. So my question to you is just a general one, and how do you feel about this? Do you think that it's good news, even if it's still, you know, that Donald Trump and Elon Musk are going to be communicating or whatever they're going to be doing together?
Yeah. You know, to the extent that I think it played a role, to the extent that people really speaking out against Musk led to Tesla sales plummeting and the truck being a disaster.
Yeah.
Anything that says to people, use all parts of your footprint to affect change, and if that means spending money differently, do it. To the extent that I think that did make Musk pretty miserable, wonderful. That's great.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. You know, I just said on an earlier program, you know, it was Citizens United that said corporate spending is speech. Well, you know what? So is our spending. If they're going to say that for them. So spend your money according to your democratic values, and do not spend a dime on companies or products that basically the profit is being used to undermine our democracy. So I think that my sense in looking at Musk is this: he's hated it. The Wisconsin loss was embarrassing. So take that as an invitation to keep putting our money where our sort of democracy is, and that's good. But no, I agree. You know, I spent a lot of time early on in the administration talking to a couple experts on data security, and maybe one of my most shared Substacks ever was where I basically had an interview that I put on a Substack and then translated on a podcast about this data security expert's fear about what Doge was actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say it, it was all about raiding our data. This
mm-hmm.
person was saying it long before it became a national storyline. And it's, I think it's exactly what they did. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, and none of that changes with Musk out of the public eye. In fact, it could be worse. Like that data clearly did not just sit in the public vaults where it's been securely. I think a lot of it's been moved. Once it's moved into private hands, who the heck knows what's happening to
yeah.
it? And Elon Musk has as much, if not more, control. You know, there were starting to be public records requests of Doge. That's the case. Well, once he goes private, you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that data could very well be. I mean, it'd be not to be negative, but it'd be shocking if it weren't there. This is how these people operate.
Yeah.
I mean, look what Musk was giving people $1 million so he would get their data for elections. Like
mm-hmm.
this is what they trade in. And so, yeah, him moving. And that was always the goal. They don't care about savings. They
no.
don't really. If they, you know, they didn't. If that was their goal, it was a failure. But
mm-hmm.
no, their goal was much more about, you know, the incredibly rich data the government has on all of us, be it labor, Social Security, you know, whatever departments they could grab from, they did. Bank accounts in some cases, contractors. Musk got access to data about labor cases that involve his companies. For goodness
mm-hmm.
sakes, they have all that, and him leaving doesn't change that at all. In fact, it probably gives him more free rein over all that data he now has.
Yeah, and I mean, the fact that he's even friendly with Vladimir Putin is kind of horrifying, because
yeah.
We all know that he wants to see American democracy destroyed. I kind of want to go back, though, about the midterms, because that's what I forgot to talk about, which was, you know, when this election first happened, and I think I've talked about this on my show before, but you know, I was devastated. So many people were devastated. Rachel Bitticoffer was very, 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 very gloomy. And she was insistent that our democracy was over and we weren't going to have any more free and fair elections. And then about maybe a month and a half ago, I saw that she tweeted that she had predicted in 2018 that the House was going to flip 40, Democrats were going to flip about 40 seats in the House or something like get 40 seats, not flip. And yes, flip. Whatever. My mind is all over the place today. I'm sorry. But either way, she said, you know, basically she thinks that this midterm is going to basically look like 2018, maybe even more Democrats winning. And so what I want to ask you about that, I mean, it's first of all, it surprised me because, like I said, she was full of doom and
right.
very, 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 you know, I hated reading her tweets. I was terrified.
Right.
And seeing what she had to say was really like the nail in the coffin. But then seeing this other tweet from her, which was completely different and basically saying, okay, we have hope now. So I know that we are going through we're in uncharted territory. All of this is new to us. And there's the sane washing of it, the acceptance of it, and all of this. But I think, like, you know, like I said, in 2018, we saw like historic turnout. Whereas in 2014 with Obama, it was the lowest, I don't know if it was just Democrats, but it was the lowest voter turnout in 80 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did see that switch over when Trump was president, and this was before COVID. And
right.
I think that, I mean, there's this hopeful, not Pollyanna, but hopeful side. And I'm just wondering if you agree or feel like maybe there is a chance that we can really do this.
I mean, I think about it differently.
Okay.
We have to.
Like yeah.
it's I don't know. I don't
right.
know the answer. But we have no choice. I mean,
yeah.
what else can we do? Just sit here and take it? So
right.
here's what I would say. Because I speak at different, you know, in person town halls or on Zoom meetings, and there's never undoubtedly the throwaway comment, we're never going to have any more elections.
Right.
What's the point? And actually, if you study the model that Donald Trump is using, just like the states of this country, the right-wing states, they are studying one person in one model, and it's Viktor Orban, and it's called competitive autocracy.
Mm-hmm.
But that model includes elections. They want to be able to claim. You look at Trump now. We have a mandate. The people want this. It's very important for them to appear that they're not dictators, but they won elections.
Yeah.
So we're going to have elections. And whenever, and I worry that whenever we say to ourselves, oh, there are no elections, it's over, we're not going to have them, that is literally sealing our own fate. Then we stop, then we're done. So they want to have elections. They want to have rules that favor them in those elections, but they need elections. That's kind of the way it works. It's not like the old Soviet Union where they don't want any. Viktor Orban has elections. We know Putin has elections. They're a joke. So what we need to do is say there will be elections, and we don't want to do it. You know, how did Trump cost Georgia two Senate seats in early January of 21 because he basically doesn't matter, going to lose no matter what. It's all rigged. That was the end of it. We don't want to do that. But we do need to know that the other half of the model where they have elections is to gerrymander and suppress the vote and do everything possible to have the playing field favor them so they win. And they have no hesitation to stack the rules in their favor. And so knowing there'll be elections, we should be gearing up and getting candidates running everywhere. We should take the energy of protests, which are wonderful, but over time channel that energy into pro-campaign energy of candidate recruitment, volunteer support, low-dollar support. But we also, and this is why, and I was up in Columbus the other day testing on this, but whether it's Congress or State House, the effort, any effort to make it harder to vote, we need to fight louder than we ever have, because that's the other half of the competitive autocracy model. It's we have elections, but we try and rig the playing field to make it very hard for us in power, even if we're in a minority, to lose. And that's why the SAVE Act is so dangerous, for example. It would greatly narrow the registration process, lock out certain people. So, no, we have no choice but to fight as hard as we can, because I think the 26 elections can be everything you and Rachel just described, a massive pushback, but fueled by really high turnout, frustration, higher costs, and Medicaid schools being undermined. Or it could be we sleep through it, and then Donald Trump claims a far bigger mandate than he can claim right now, where he barely won an election that in hindsight for him to lose. So we've got to go for it, and we can't, more than trying to predict it, we just need to make it happen. And that starts now.
Okay, we have to take a quick break, but we will be back after this message. Hey, real quick, this is Kimberly, the host of the show you're listening to right now. If you like what you're hearing, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/startmeup. Take a look at the different tiers, choose one, and be my patron today. Thank you in advance. Okay, we're back. So I want to bring this back to the SAVE Act and what I like to call the big government tax bill, not the big beautiful bill. First of all, let's start with, I saw you did you tweeted out that rural Ohio school districts, say the proposed budget will hurt them. So I want to know, and that's from the big bill, right? The big tax bill. And I'm just wondering, could you talk about that a little bit, how it's going to hurt school districts?
And this is why it's so important about running all over this country, not just bring about, 28 presidential primaries and who we like the best. The Elon Musk voucherization, Donald Trump Project 2025 plan is terrible for public schools in rural America. And if you know rural America and red America, there is no institution that matters more to the communities in rural America than their local public school. There is not some other school that people have a voucher to use at. It's the local school, and that's it. For in most places, that's it. In other places, maybe some tiny alternative. And if you go to these communities, which I do, they will swear by their school. They know the teachers. They know the principal. All their kids went there. They went there. And I think that once you start looking at what happens when you cut Title I funding and you send it to afford vouchers for higher end private schools. Basically what you're in at the state level, cutting public schools again to pay for vouchers. And that was what the story was that I tweeted about. The people who are paying urban schools pay the price, but so do rural public schools.
Yeah.
Money is literally, I mean, imagine running. This is why they need to gerrymander, because if you had a fair district, they would lose on this issue.
Yeah.
Imagine running around a rural community and saying, hey, everyone, your school's suffering. You're paying more to play basketball because we took some of the money that used to go to this school and we sent it to a private school in the suburbs so that kids who literally could afford that school get a $6,000 break on tuition. That's the worst politics imaginable. That's essentially the scam. And so, but when we're not running in these places, no one tells them that. They blame the school's collapse on, you know, critical race theory being taught somewhere. Like it's crazy, or the border, when it's in fact the policies of a state house or Washington that are doing it. So I think it's terrible for public education. It's undermining public education, but it also happens to be horrible politics for the right if we do a better job of explaining exactly what's happening. And that's why, you know, it's painful, but we're only going to reverse it if we are running in more places and aggressively embracing public education and being very tough on what they're doing when they push all these privatization schemes on these communities.
So that just kind of brings me to Democratic messaging and the idea that, you know, we're seeing some really strong Democratic elected leaders, and then we're also seeing some weak ones. And I think right now the party as a whole is kind of struggling how to deal with this fascist regime. I think that, you know, there are a few of them who are feeling like we are, let's pretend everything is like it used to be, and let's call them our friends across the aisle and see if we can compromise with them. And then there are people like Jasmine Crockett and, you know, Chris Murphy and Pritzker who are calling it like it is. And I think I think it's obvious if you look on social media, who is getting the attention. You know, AOC is getting attention. Pritzker is getting attention. Van Hollen is getting attention. And they're all standing up. They're all resisting. And I'm just, you know, I know that you don't have an answer as to when the Democratic Party is going to figure this out. But do you see any sense of, growth in that area or better messaging finding its way through? Do you think that the Democratic Party is really so, they're just struggling right now? How are you feeling about that, you know, on the whole?
I think that obviously people are seeing that the more bold message does create a much bigger, you know, frenzy is not the right word, but it's just drawing a lot more noise and crowds and small dollar giving to the extent that shows you something. I think people see that. And I actually think, you know, the worst moment was the first couple of weeks after Trump took office. It was clear there was no plan whatsoever. Like there was. It was just silence. And then to his credit, Senator Andy Kim showed up at USAID and wouldn't get let in. And that started to show them. And then the town halls and protests started. And I think now Jasmine Crockett and AOC were already there. But I think that the people have started to show that if you're on the Democratic side, we need you to fight. And I actually think a lot of what's happened is this people-driven movement to have these town halls with empty seats and all that, giving some backbone to people who probably weren't sure, especially if they're from more moderate districts, what they're supposed to do. So I think that's really important. I do think the budget and some of the other outcomes we're seeing right now, though, also opens up more opportunities. If all we do, and I have a book called Saving Democracy, so I could be faulted for this as well. If all we do is talk about democracy at 30,000 foot level, although we should, and we should never back away from that. I do think getting to issues like I just did, public schools being undermined, Medicaid being cut, risks to Social Security. I do think talking about that fiercely, but talking about it again with people who aren't just Democrats is also how we're going to win. So I think we need to do both. But I don't, and again, not everyone will like this, I don't think being super polite about it all is sending the message that, you know, we're in a crisis. This is an alarming moment. And if you feel that way, it needs to come across, because if it feels like you're acting like it's politics as usual, that's what people will think. And all of a sudden that it all gets normalized. So, but I think, I feel as intensely about the destruction of public schools as I do about the fact that they're violating court orders. And I think we should make sure we're not only talking about the lawless stuff, because in that rural community where that may not break through as much, destroying their public schools is the thing that might make them think, my gosh, I can't deal with this. I want to change this. So I think we got to have we have enough issues that really are directly impactful on people's lives that we're equally spirited about.
We've talked about your book, Saving Democracy, before, and I kind of want to bring that up again, because I know that there are so many people out there like me who feel like I want to do something and I'm afraid and I don't know what's going on. And so I'm just wondering if you can offer any suggestions or, you know, inspiration for people, whether or not they feel comfortable, you know, going out and doing something. Because I remember the last time you were here, you were talking about going to like the local library and seeing if you could set up a voter registration or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are things people can do, whether they're, you know, social, if they're very social people, or if they're more loners and they don't like to deal with other people like right. me. So, I mean, I'm good socially, but still sometimes it's really difficult to deal with people. So what are your recommendations?
So I'm actually finishing up right now a second edition to the Saving Democracy
All
book
right.
to accommodate the current era and additional things. But bigger picture, and I write this in the book, but it picks up on what the first edition talked about. The ways that parties have climbed out of being in the hole that Democrats are now in, and I expressed this earlier, has never been sitting around and daydreaming about the presidential election 4 years later. That's not what Karl Rove was doing in 2000. Yeah. In 2009, when the world had declared the Republican Party was essentially extinct after Obama won, what did Karl Rove do? He started making sure they were running for state mm-hmm. house and local seats all over, mm-hmm. including in places where they had lost. And he joined that recruiting effort with the energy of the Tea Party, mm-hmm. and I was a candidate in 10, so I lived through this, and they crushed it, and mm-hmm. they won back Michigan. They won Michigan and Wisconsin, states that Obama won easily. They mm-hmm. won the state house races there, and so I think one thing is, to the extent you're involved in politics, again, channel energy from, and I think the protests are very important. I think being on the street, being seen, is very important. Right now, I think I look at other countries and I see their massive numbers of people they bring out when there are moments of outrage. We need to see that here. Mm-hmm. But as we do that, use that energy, just like happened it with the Tea Party years ago, to turn it into a campaign movement for 2025 and 26 elections. So to the extent you're sort of more into politics and campaigning, know that that starts now. Mm-hmm. And that matters. Like you said, 26 is everything. Mm-hmm. And if we can have surprise wins because we've started to work now, there may be nothing more important in the next 10 years than the 26th cycle. Mm. But on the flip side, like the less partisan stuff, you know, one thing I always say is, look at the right wing, they know what their plan is and they know how it succeeds and they know how it's stymied. And so the SAVE Act is a clue about what scares them. And the SAVE Act in the end basically is upending the voter registration process.
Mm-hmm.
They want to, through the lie of that non-citizens are voting everywhere, they want to really make it harder to register voters, mm-hmm. because they know that the moments where democracy has been lifted the most came, like after the Voting Rights Act and the Civil War, through massive voter registration drives.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my little like clue, okay? If they're scared of voter registration drives, an active, nonstop, continuous voter registration as the front door to new people in democracy, it's a hint to us to go do all that all the time.
Yeah. Because
they know that, and they've been trying to clamp down on this stuff through purges, through other things for years. They don't want it happening on college campuses. And I go through this in the book, like whether it's figuring out ways to have high schools be places that people turning 18 register or pre-register, whether it's college campuses, whether it's homeless shelters, health clinics, anything that you can do in your life that you're already doing, that you can convert to a place that voters who have been left out of democracy are engaged enough to register and stay involved, they know that that's the biggest threat to them. So if they know it, let's do it. And yeah. I don't know if the SAVE Act will become law. My hope is it'll get stuck in the Senate. But especially do it if we see that they are trying to clamp down on it. So do it as much as you can right now. So that's sort of the less political. And then one other thing real quick. I mean, I really do laud people who, and it's thousands of people who basically said, I don't want a dime spent on Tesla. Nothing. I want that company. If they're going to lift autocracy and you know, push crazy South Africa theories and all this other stuff, I'm not participating. Well, look around as to other ways you can do that with other companies that also look as if they're part of the Trump autocracy plan and not part of lifting all of us. Like, put your money where democracy is.
Yeah.
That makes a difference. We're seeing it with Musk sort of trying to at least look like he's not publicly involved anymore. That was a lot of people making a collective decision that really did matter.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And I do, despite everything that's happening, I do have some hope. So that leads me to my last question, and that is, what do you think we have to be hopeful about?
I mean, I do think overall, although there have been moments of disappointment, I do think we're starting to see more people fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
One of the lowest moments in recent months were the law firms caving.
Yes.
Law firms who know the law.
Right.
And law firms who know the law should know that everything Trump is doing to shake them down is completely illegal. So my free advice is no one should want to have these law firms represent them because they're not good lawyers. They caved the moment the dispute started. You don't want that as your lawyer. They also gave away all their principles. What I like seeing, and that's true, you know, Columbia, I thought, you know, not to get all the details, Columbia caved too quickly. Mm-hmm. What I like seeing right now is others are starting to push back. You know, the dean of the Georgetown Law School wrote an amazing letter when that, for a time at least, that Ed Martin was sort of the acting U.S. Attorney of D.C. And he said, I'm not going to hire Georgetown law students. And this dean's response was amazing, pointing out just how unconstitutional that was. You know, Harvard's pushback. By the way, Harvard's main lawyers are two very conservative, right, you know, lawyers who often are important in Trump world. Good for them.
Yeah.
Most of these are winning cases. And we have to change the sort of the culture that you're looked upon as doing something wrong by caving, and you're looked upon as lifting democracy by fighting.
Yeah.
And I do think that's starting. Like, the law firms are winning. And by the way, the law firms who are caving, and there have been stories about this, are learning the lesson that you know, Republican officials have learned for years to their regret. Once you cave, it doesn't stop.
Right.
It gets worse. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you cave to Trump. Now you got some right-wing freak show showing up in line for pro bono help. I mean, it will never stop.
Yeah.
They'll demand more. And what I do like overall, like, we can either comply or defy. And I think those who are defying, although it's difficult, I mean, it's not easy, it's the only choice versus mm-hmm. just complying. Because in the end, if you comply, you basically lose your soul and your institution. In
yeah.
the end. So that's good to see. I do think people, and it may, I don't want to die out. I worry it may in the summer. I do think people showing up and really going to town halls and protests is a really important thing, especially if we're smart enough to channel into a full-out campaign effort in elections here next year. And then I do think a lot of the federal judges across the board, Bush appointees, Obama appointees, even Trump appointees, are generally standing up. I think the next phase will have to be, they have to be equally tough on contempt of court possibilities as they are ruling things illegal. So those are all things that give me hope. And again, our number one goal here is to get through the next year and a half and get ourselves a House that can't vote for this stuff. And to the extent all these things happening at once, slow things down against this sort of, what's the flood the zone strategy?
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that is bearing some fruit amid a lot of things that are also very frustrating and hard to watch.
I just want to add, you know, I was on the Politics Bar with Jody Hamilton and Sean Pierce, and Jody had mentioned, and I can't remember who she cited, but she was listening to somebody's podcast, and they recommended that if you go to one of these protests and there are, you know, bad actors or any violence breaks out, the recommendation is just to sit down. And, you know, that's going to indicate to the authorities that, you know, you're not doing anything wrong And that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be saved from whatever they might do, but it's just a good idea to kind of sit down. So yes. I thought that was a good piece of advice, and I wanted to share that.
I agree. They would love to have an excuse to crack down on these things.
Yeah, right.
They would. I mean, they haven't done it yet. That, you know, and my guess is he gets a lot of pushback on using the military to police protests.
Right.
And, but they would, Trump, like he tried to do in 2020, would love to have an excuse to do that. So that, that's good advice.
Yeah, we can't give that to them. And we can absolutely basically count on the fact that they're going to throw in some bad actors at some point, because protests have been happening, you know, pretty much every day. Rachel Maddow has pointed out that she is happy to see the resistance is stronger than anyone predicted. And so, you know, with the boycotts of Tesla, with, you know, Target losing money, all of that, that's really good news. And I think I have a feeling, you know, I don't know if there's going to be a slowdown in the summer just because it's the summer, but I have this feeling that it's not going to go away. I think people are afraid and they're uncomfortable. And when people are afraid and uncomfortable, they're more likely to do something. So I do think we're going to see, you know, there is the no kings thing. There is, you know, the hands off. So protests are being organized, and there's, you know, you can always boycott. There were some scheduled boycotts. I haven't seen anything new come down the pike on that. But either way, I think there, you know, definitely we are in for even more damage and destruction. That's clear and evident. But I think that the way we can look at this, and maybe I'm wrong, but the way we can look at all this damage and destruction, it is fuel to get us to the polls, to get us to, you know, get people running. And we saw a huge number of, I don't have the numbers in front of me because, you know, you scroll and you see something, but ultimately the number of people that have gotten involved, whether it's, you know, running for office or signing up to learn how to do it, I think it's even bigger than it was in 2016. That might have been from, what's his name? Steve Pearson, who I don't know if you know who he is, but he does a podcast, the Practivist podcast with Jess Craven. So I believe it was, that's where it came from. So that is very helpful. You know,
there's
we're seeing
a new generation, young, really.
Yes.
It's not different ages, but I think you still have, you know, the groups, and I got to know a lot of them in 18, like there was the whole sort of set of indivisible groups and others. And they're still around. They're still fighting. But in the new protests, and by the way, the protests I've been to and I've spoken at several have been, like you said, have been very well done.
Yeah.
Peaceful. I love all the signs. But it's been a new generation. There's a lot of new people who weren't involved in even the 17 and 18 ones. So I do think they're bigger. And there's a new energy to them, which has been great.
Yes. Woohoo. All right. Well, it's always good talking to you. And I know, like, I wish the circumstances were better, but we're in this together and your voice is so important. I highly recommend to everybody read Saving Democracy by David Pepper. It's on Amazon. I've linked it. Read it because you'll get some really great ideas, and it's ideas for anybody, you know, whether you're a really social person or you're a really private person, it doesn't matter. There's all kinds of things we can do, but what we shouldn't do is, like David said, just sit there and worry. Worry's not going to help. Worry's not a strategy. So, David, before you go, please tell everyone where to find you, all the places.
So the best place is, I'm still on Twitter and Blue Sky. I guess I'm stubborn about calling it Twitter, but also I'm quite active on Substack and both the sort of the posting part of it. But I send out basically a daily newsletter with a good amount of content. So that's it at David Pepper. I think it's called Pepperspectives, but if you look up David Pepper, you'll find it at Substack. So if you like this stuff, follow me there too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your wisdom and for everything you do and for being on the show.
Thanks, everybody. Hang in there.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your cachava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of cachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS.